Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. In honor of July being National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, I would like to welcome you all to the Cultural Competency Toolkit and Training Teleconference. On behalf of the STAR Center and the University of Illinois at Chicago National Research Training Center, Center on Mental Health Services. The STAR Center is one of five SAMHSA-funded technical assistance centers established to provide specified services in which focus on cultural competency, consumer empowerment, and self-help tools. The cultural competence tool that we'll be discussing today was developed as a joint venture among our featured presenters today on the call. The title of the tool is Cultural Competency in Mental Health Peer 1 Programs and Self-Help Groups. This tool is available for free at www.consumerstar.org, as well as www.cmhsrp.uic.edu. This has been the most successful STAR product to date, and I will repeat the websites again at the end of our call just to ensure that you all have access. My name is Philip Swallow, and I am Program Manager of the STAR Center, and I am honored to be giving the introductions today. In order to enhance the tool's effectiveness, we have brought together the parties responsible for creating the tool to discuss its relevant background and the best uses of the product. Our presenters today include Dr. Judith A. Cook with the University of Illinois Chicago, National Research and Training Center, Center on Mental Health Services, Research and Policy. Her colleague, Senior Program Manager, Marie M. Hamilton. And, of course, yours truly, NAMI STAR Center Director, Stephen Kiosk. After our teleconference, we will be sending emailing you all a survey. We ask that you all take the time to fill that out. It helps us to ensure that we're providing quality programming. Finally, not only do we appreciate your participation on this call, we extend gratitude to the SAMHSA, the funding from SAMHSA that makes such programming possible. So without further ado, I would like to turn the call over to Dr. Cook. Hello, Dr. Cook. How are you?
Fine, Philip. Thank you very, very much for that nice introduction. What I'd like to do is start by reviewing today's agenda. Hopefully, all of you were able to download the agenda when you registered for the call or when you received the listserv announcement about today's training. But for those of you who don't have it in front of you, I'd like to go over it so you know what to expect. The call will last approximately an hour and a half, and at the end, we'll be taking questions that we'd like to get from you via email, and more about that later. We're going to first talk about developing your cultural competency vision. Steve will say a little bit about that in a moment. And then next, I'd like to give you a quick overview of the toolkit and how we developed it and pilot tested it. Next, we'd like to dig in and take a look at the different toolkit sections. I'll be starting with some important definitions that you'll need in order to understand the orientation of the toolkit, how to conduct the assessment of your program or support group, and how to create your action plan to enhance your group or program's cultural competency. Next, Marie will talk about the five focus areas that are dealt with in the tool. After that, I'll talk about how to assess your program's cultural competency, how to use the assessment part of the toolkit, difficulties that you may run into when you go to assess your program or group, and some tips and resources that you can use to conduct an honest and a helpful assessment. After that, Steve will talk about how you might use the results of your assessment to develop an action plan for your group or program. This action plan is key because it's the ingredients in that plan that go into enhancing the cultural competency of your organization or group. Following that, Marie is going to talk about examples from the action plans of the Peer Run programs who helped us by pilot testing the toolkit. And she'll give you some real-world examples of what they put in their plans and the challenges they encountered when they went to enact their plans. After that, Steve is going to talk about resources that you can use, both in conducting your assessment, in developing your action plan, and enhancing your group or program's cultural competency overall. And at the very end of today's training, we'll take questions and feedback from the audience that we'd like you to send us by emailing me at the following email address. That's cook@ripco.com, COOK at R as in Robert, I as in interest, P as in purchase, C as in cook, O as in order.com. So if any questions occur to you throughout today's training, just send them in and we'll try to deal with all of them, time permitting. So now that I've reviewed the agenda, I'd like to turn it over to Steve to talk about what to think about and what to do in developing your cultural competency vision. Steve?
Thank you, Judith. First, I'd like to ask a question to folks listening is why might you want to develop a cultural competency plan, and what is this vision all about? You may or may not know that for a lot of underserved communities, mental health services and peer-run services in particular can serve as a complement to, or even some cases, as an alternative to formal mental health services and treatment activities. Some of the benefits of developing a vision for multicultural competence include a likelihood of reduced distress for folks emotionally and cognitively, or psychiatric distress, as some folks say. Also reduces the likelihood for hospitalization. And also the peer group supports and services can greatly improve social skills and abilities, and also increase experience of hope. And indirectly, of course, a decreased use of formal services that for many underserved groups may not be all that accessible or welcoming to begin with. There are some very real mental health access to treatment service disparities among different population and communities, and folks who are from a non-majority or non-dominant culture would be more likely to either delay or even avoid seeking any of the more traditional services. So developing a vision for competence can include the desire to have a more dynamic, a transforming community or organization that can really access, include, and tap into the strengths of different individuals and groups within a community, in addition to, of course, the benefits that would be expressed and supported for recovery and wellness and the increase in daily skills and abilities. So a vision for cultural competency and a plan involves welcome, inclusion, reaching out, and really a sense of curiosity and open-mindedness to who's around and what can take place and what needs to take place and who's missing from the services. This is a very rewarding process, and as we'll talk about in a little bit, the pilot sites who used the cultural competence tool and created their action plans had some, in some cases, remarkable responses and results. So now for a quick overview of the toolkit and how it was developed, I would like to turn it back over to Judith. Judith?
Thanks, Steve. I wanted to start my overview of the toolkit by acknowledging Ray Guevara, who was the first director of the NAMI Star Center. This is really his brainchild and something that he very much wanted to see become reality. And he kicked off the project by conducting focus groups and individual interviews with consumer leaders around the country, with programs that weren't very culturally diverse, peer-run programs that weren't very culturally diverse but wanted to become more so. He also spoke with peers around the country who were not participating in peer-run programs to get some better understanding of why not, and developed the idea of creating a document that would involve both an assessment that a program could do in order to identify where it was doing well in terms of its cultural competency and where it might want to target some improvements. We then worked with Jim McNulty, the next director of the STAR Center, who helped us develop elements that I'll talk about in a moment that we used to gather information and ideas to help create the toolkit. And finally, we worked with Steve Kiosk, the current director of the NAMI STAR Center, to bring the toolkit into reality and also to conduct the pilot test. One of the things that we did, based on the focus groups and the individual interviews that Ray did, was to conduct a web-based survey of people in recovery who did and didn't use peer-run programs and peer-run support groups. We wanted to talk to both groups, people who had and had not used peer-run services and supports, because we wanted to get a better idea of some of the challenges programs face, and some of the myths and realities people who are not using peer-run programs, who are members of racial and ethnic minorities and other minority groups, what some of their views were about peer-run programs so that we could tackle some of those in the way we designed the tool. We conducted this web-based survey and analyzed the results, and the results are available in a journal article that is also available on the webpage that Philip spoke about at the beginning of today's talk. If you would like to receive a copy of the article with the results of the web survey of people in recovery, you could also send me an email, and I'll send it out to you electronically, or if you send me your mail address, I'll snail mail it to you. We used those results and the opinions of folks that we had talked to and conducted focus groups with to prepare the first draft of the toolkit collaboratively. And we had it reviewed by a number of experts in the area of peer services, cultural diversity, and cultural competency training. And those individuals are acknowledged in the toolkit on the page that says with expert reviewers. And after that, we recruited a number of peer-run programs and support groups who were willing to pilot test the version that we had created, see whether it was workable, whether it was understandable, whether it met their needs, whether we needed to add or subtract certain elements. And I want to acknowledge those programs because they were, I think, instrumental in helping us understand how peer-run programs and support groups might use this tool, the difficulties they might encounter in doing so, and creative ways and strategies to get around those difficulties, many of which we incorporated into the final version of the toolkit that's in your hands today. These included the Amarillo Area Mental Health Consumers in Texas, Cheers Incorporated of Arizona, Empowerment Initiatives in Oregon, The Gathering Place in Wisconsin, Project Return Support Network in California, Prosumers International in Arizona, as well as Recovery Empowerment Network in Arizona, United Self-Help in Hawaii, and the Wellness Shack in Wisconsin. So I'd like to give a big shout out to those peer-run programs for being willing to be the first to pilot test it and then to be on calls with us every other week to talk about what it was like to use the tool, what kind of problems they were encountering, and ways to surmount those obstacles in order to move forward with their action plans. The toolkit is organized, and you can take a look at the table of contents, into five basic sessions. These are the five critical elements that the tool asks you to think about in your support group or program as you're conducting your assessment and making your action plan. There's an introductory part before these five sections talking a little bit about why you might want to engage in this effort, some definitions that I'll cover in a moment, how to use the tool, and how we evaluated and refined the tool. Then, after the five focus areas are covered, there's a page, page 21 this is, for you to use in developing your cultural competency assessment ratings. And then there are some challenges discussed that were common to many of the programs who pilot tested the tool. And some throughout the tool, there are tip boxes and bright idea boxes that are things you might want to try as you're engaging in different phases of using the tool. There's a page for you to create your own diversity action plan, but when you registered, you also received a longer diversity action plan format that Steve will talk about in a moment. We suggest that you use this instead simply because it allows you to write more information down. But if you need to use the version that's on page 23 of the actual tool, that will work as well. There are a number of resources in the back of the tool, and Steve will talk about those in a moment. So that's a quick overview of the toolkit, how it was developed and pilot tested. And what I'd like to do now is to turn to a review of the critical parts of the toolkit, starting with the basic definitions that you need to be clear about in using the tool and in developing your action plan. The first of the important concepts we ask you to think about is the notion of cultural diversity. When we talk about cultural diversity, we're referring to the unique characteristics that all of us have. These are the things that distinguish us as individuals, and they also identify us as members of different groups. For example, I'm a researcher who studies peer-run programs and peer-delivered services. But I also belong to a group of social science researchers, and I also belong to a group that strongly believes that people with mental health problems can recover and can use that experience to help others to live successful, productive lives. So that's an individual characteristic that I have, but also a characteristic that leads me to be a member of other groups. The idea of cultural diversity refers to the richness in people's defining characteristics, such as their race or ethnicity. This is often what people focus on when they're thinking about cultural competency. We're going to challenge you, and the tool challenges you, to think beyond just that characteristic when you're thinking about your own program's diversity. We're also talking about people's socioeconomic status, their gender, their religious affiliation, their sexual orientation, their family identification, their immigration status, their functional ability, their age, and any number of other characteristics that are important in their lives. So that's the concept of cultural diversity. I'd like to turn next to the concept of cultural competency. It's related to diversity, but it's different. It refers to a person's ability to interact with people from different cultures in a way that's comfortable for both parties, and also in a way that's effective in accomplishing whatever the relationship is intended to accomplish. It might be a friendship. It might be a helping relationship. It might be a work or a business relationship. There are four important aspects to cultural competency. And when you run into problems or barriers in doing your assessment or creating and moving forward with your plan, it's often helpful to come back and review these four important aspects. The first involves being aware of your own beliefs, your own prejudices, and discriminatory behavior. We all have these, and it's important to be aware of them and to recognize them. The second is changing your attitudes about people who aren't like you in terms of things like their race or ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and other characteristics. The third aspect of cultural competency is acquiring knowledge about the history, the beliefs, and the practices of different cultures. That's why people who think that they're culturally competent because they, quote, treat everyone the same, end quote, are misguided. Cultural competency involves being aware of the history and differences and also in acknowledging them in your relationships with other people, in how you structure and organize your program. So if you treat everybody the same, by definition, you are not culturally competent. Finally, the fourth component of cultural competency is developing communication skills. This is probably something we all would benefit from, but here we're talking about developing the communication skills you need to interact sensitively with people from a number of different cultures. So that's cultural competency. Let's turn next to an important concept called the dynamics of difference. The dynamics of difference is all about power imbalances, unequal power relationships, and the fact that these exist between people of different cultures. These power differentials can lead to misperceptions, distrust, and misunderstandings when people communicate with each other and try to have relationships. If you are working on increasing your cultural competency, you understand that power imbalances happen when people from more advantaged groups, generally white, service provider, wealthy, director of a program, interact with people from less advantaged communities, non-white, service recipient, poor, members of a program. Understanding the dynamics of difference also involves being open to correcting your behavior based on constructive feedback from people who are not like you. If you don't ask people whether there are power imbalances between you and them, if you don't think about the fact that they may come from a culture or group that either historically or traditionally has had less power than the group you represent, then you're not paying attention to the dynamics of difference. When we talk about a culturally competent program, we're referring to an organization that takes account of the dynamics of difference by asking its members, who are not members of the majority groups, whether they feel comfortable with the structure, the surroundings, the services and activities that the organization engages in. The point with dynamics of difference is being willing to be self-critical and also to be critical of your organization in order to help people from different communities feel comfortable and feel like they belong in your program. The uncomfortable thing about dynamics of difference is it involves putting yourself in a somewhat uncomfortable position. But that's what it takes many times in order to learn the information you need in order to enhance your program and help everyone feel welcome. Finally, it's the idea of the most prevalent cultural group. It refers to the most common groups in your program or your support group's local community, aside from white English speakers. These include racial ethnicity groups, age, gender, immigration status, disability status, and so on. It's very important at the beginning of your program's effort to know what some of the most prevalent cultural groups are in your local community. And what we show you in the toolkit is how to visit a website run by the U.S. Bureau of the Census that will help you discover the most prevalent groups in your city, town, county, or zip code area. It will tell you what races and ethnicities are represented in your local community. It will also give you a good idea of how many young people, middle-aged, and older individuals reside in your community. This website address is provided in the appendix to the tool, and Steve is also going to tell you a little bit more about using that website later on in today's training. But right now, after defining the important concepts that we base the toolkit around, I'm going to turn it over to Marie, who's going to talk about the five focus areas that you'll find in the toolkit. Marie?
Thanks, Judith. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the five focus areas that are included in the assessment tool. Each focus area assesses different aspects of your organization. It's important to complete the assessment for each of the five focus areas. Initially, not all the areas may be relevant to your group or organization. You may not have a grievance policy or a mission statement. However, this tool and these five focus areas will give you an opportunity to work on further developing your program. These focus areas will identify activities, materials, and policies that can help your organization better address diversity issues and multiculturalism. It will also give you a way to track the growth and development of your organization. So the first focus area is administration, policies, and guidelines. And for those of you who are following along in the tool itself, that would be on page 5. Each organization has procedures, policies, and guidelines for how things work and how people interact with one another. Sometimes these are written formal policies, and sometimes these are informal arrangements. However, this structure sets the tone for supporting cultural diversity. In this section, you will look at policies, documents, and/or organizational composition to see if your program is supportive and inclusive of people of different cultures. One indicator that you would use to assess your program is your program's mission statement and introductory materials that you hand out to people when they come in. Is your mission statement available in the languages that are spoken by community members? Do you have introductory materials that are in other languages? A second indicator is your policies and guidelines or your rules of conduct. Do you have a policy or commitment to non-discriminatory practices? A third indicator would be the conflict or grievance procedures for your organization. Are the procedures sensitive to communication needs and norms across cultures? And a fourth indicator would be whether your program has a procedure in place to gather feedback from your members. Do you get feedback from members regarding satisfaction with your program? And does this feedback include questions about the program's ability to meet the needs of individuals from different communities? This first focus area is one that many organizations choose to include in their action plan. It can be a good place to start addressing diversity issues. In addition, organizations can usually make progress fairly quickly in updating some policies or materials. And this helps to create a sense of accomplishment and progress in terms of cultural diversity. The second focus area are peer providers and group leaders, and that's located on page 8. Since peers are the key to providing self-help and mutual assistance, their cultural skills are critical for engaging and supporting people with mental health issues. Many of these skills stem from shared experiences of mental health problems and social stigma. However, it is important to realize that an individual's culture may shape the way they view mental health challenges and peer support. Peer programs will be more effective if they can accommodate these different cultural perspectives regarding mental health. Everybody, no matter their background, has things to learn about how people from diverse backgrounds view their mental health experiences and how they wish to be treated. That is why cultural competency should be required of all peer providers, their leaders, and the programs they run. The following indicators can be used to help determine if your program is inclusive in terms of peer providers and group leaders. Look at the cultural composition of your peer staff, volunteers, and leadership. Do they reflect the most prevalent cultural groups in your community? A second indicator is your organization's policies or group guidelines about training and education. Do these guidelines require peer providers and leadership to receive formal training on cultural competency? And another indicator focuses on observations of interactions among diverse peer staff and volunteers. Do performance reviews include notations about cross-cultural communication skills? Do staff and/or volunteers have the ability to respond to different cultural beliefs about the causes and treatment of emotional and psychiatric distress? There are more indicators for each focus area included in the assessment tool, but I wanted to give you a sense of some of the things you'll be looking at to assess your program's cultural competency in terms of the different focus areas. The third focus area is services and supports, and that's located on page 11. Service effectiveness is enhanced by tailoring treatment and wellness approaches to recipients' personal characteristics and heritage. People naturally respond to peer programs that accommodate their worldviews, traditions, and customs. And this is why cultural competency is so important. There are major cultural differences in how people define and respond to mental health and behavioral challenges. In some cultures, emotional distress is not viewed as an illness or chemical imbalance, but as a spiritual crisis. In other cultures, emotional distress is something that is talked about only within the family. It is important to realize that culture impacts how each person views mental health and behavioral challenges. We also need to be aware that sometimes people from the same cultures will view these same issues differently. Sometimes this will depend on how much some individuals have come to accept Western values and ideas, and other times these differences are just normal variations within cultures and families. The following indicators will help your program determine if it is welcoming to and inclusive of people from different cultures. The levels of awareness among staff and members regarding different cultural traditions and customs related to mental illness, help seeking, and recovery. So in this case, you would want to, within everyday interactions, staff, leadership, and members acknowledge and incorporate different views about mental illness, help seeking, and recovery. Another indicator would be the degree to which services and supports offered by your program incorporate multicultural beliefs and approaches. Here you would look at manuals, curricula, and other materials used by your program to see if they specifically mention multicultural beliefs and approaches. It is also helpful to look at the number of partnerships you have with diverse organizations in your community. Another indicator would be the cultural composition of your membership. Do participants in your program reflect the prevalent cultural groups in your community? And are program members appropriately diverse, culturally and otherwise? The fourth program area is program or group environment, and that's on page 15. Cultural acceptance and inclusion can be communicated by your program's physical environment. Potential members often feel more welcome when they see people who look like them in the posters, paintings, or other artwork in your program's public spaces. Providing reading materials from different cultures or in different languages also communicates a sense that diverse cultures are welcome. In addition, ensuring that your program is accessible to people with physical disabilities lets others know that your program is available to all people who need emotional support. The following indicators will help you determine if your program or group environment is welcoming to people from diverse cultures. Multicultural decorations are present in your program's posters and artwork. When you're looking around your program space, do you see diverse groups present in the images and content of the brochures and reading materials used in your program or group? Another indicator would be that non-Western, non-Christian holidays are celebrated or acknowledged. Does your program offer multi-ethnic music and food at celebrations or holiday events? An additional indicator is that diverse groups are represented among the peers in your program or group. So do the people who staff and attend your program represent the most prevalent cultural groups in your community? And the final focus area is communication and language capacity on page 18. Effective communication is key to making people feel welcome and understood. One way this happens is when providers and group leaders are able to match their verbal and nonverbal cues to their clients' cultural norms. One example is that in some cultures, people are uncomfortable with direct eye contact and prefer to look away when speaking to others as a sign of respect. It is important that peer staff be aware of cultural preferences so that they can interact in a way that is comfortable for potential members. In addition, some people who wish to attend peer programs may not speak English, so they will need access to peers who speak their language. Another consideration is people with communication disabilities. Individuals who are deaf or blind may require accommodations, such as sign language interpreters or materials that are tape recorded or in braille or large print. The following indicators will help you determine how inclusive your program is. Do the languages in your program materials used represent the most prevalent cultural groups in your community? What is the language or the languages used on intake or other program forms? What language or languages are used in phone reception or voicemail readings? And do you have multilingual peer or staff leaders? Another indicator would be observations of your services, meetings, and groups. Do staff, leadership, and participants use or respect differing communication norms? A third indicator is whether your program is accessible to individuals who are deaf or hearing impaired. Are sign language interpreters available, or do you have staff or volunteers who can sign? Is a TDD available to communicate, or are your peer staff and leaders familiar with using the operator relay system on the telephone system? And are tape-recorded materials available, or are materials available in Braille or large print? Each of these sections in the tool regarding the focus areas also provide ideas regarding some of the next steps you can take to become more inclusive and culturally sensitive. Judith mentioned this a little bit in her overview. In addition, you'll see examples of activities that some of the programs in our pilot tests included in their action plans, and later in this call we'll give you some other examples of activities that have been included in their action plans. Now Judith is going to talk about developing a process for using this tool to assess your program.
Thanks, Marie. At this point, we're going to turn to what will probably be the second thing that your organizational group will do after they've read the introduction to the toolkit and thought a little bit about the definitions that I talked about earlier and have become a little bit familiar with the five areas that Marie just described and why they matter. The assessment of your group or organization is a difficult thing in some ways. It's difficult to be critical of an organization that you all know and love and have a lot of pride in. Many peer-run programs have spent a lot of time trying to make people feel comfortable and to address power imbalances, particularly those that arise in the mental health service delivery system. So recognizing that some still exist in certain ways can be difficult for an organization or some members of the organization. This is all a way of saying that this is not an assessment that you want an individual to do by themselves. We recommend that you do this in a group. One way you might do this is to form a diversity committee or to use a committee that already exists. So, for example, you might have a leadership committee, and you might decide that every member of the leadership committee is going to work together on this toolkit. It's a very good idea not to have an individual do this because we don't want one person alone to become identified with this effort. This needs to be an effort that the organization as a whole decides they want to adopt and embrace and go forward with. That doesn't mean that every single member of the organization needs to be okay about that or even to feel the same degree of comfort about that. But it is something that you want your general membership and leadership, if those are separate in your organization or group, to feel is important and to want to cooperate with. In addition to making sure you have a committee, more than one person, you're going to want to make sure that that committee is as diverse as possible. If you have a program that has some people who are paid staff and other people who are not paid staff, you're going to want to make sure that representatives from both of those groups are on your diversity committee. You are going to want to make sure that as much as you can, people from different races and ethnicities and sexual orientations and age groups from your membership are participating in the diversity committee. In a couple of cases, we've heard of groups that have invited a community leader who's a racial or ethnic minority group member or a member of another group to participate with the organization on its diversity committee. What you really want is a variety of opinions and viewpoints that will take a good, honest, hard look at your program and how it operates. we suggest that at this stage of the assessment conducting, that you try to meet every week. That you not try to sit down and do the assessment all in one meeting, because what you're going to find is that in some cases, you're going to need to go out and obtain the information that's necessary in order to do the rating for that particular dimension. So, for example, if you're rating how people interact with each other, you probably don't just want to carry everybody's immediate impressions of what that's like into your rating. You're probably going to want to say, let's take a week and informally observe interactions between people, and then come back to the group and talk a little bit about what we're seeing. And so it's very, very important to provide enough time for the assessment to occur, and having a regularly scheduled meeting about this makes it more likely for the assessment to get completed and to get completed in an honest and thorough way. Honesty is really important, and I think that while this can be hard, the peer-run programs that pilot tested the toolkit with us were, I thought, very, very good at taking a long, hard look at themselves. Also, finding the information that you need can be difficult. And this is particularly the case when you go to find out that, you know, the assessment is organized around features of an organization that don't necessarily match the way your organization is run, the way your organization has its policies, and the way your organization operates. So you may find as you go to conduct the assessment that you have to take the spirit of the assessment and apply that to making judgments about your program rather than trying to apply the actual words that you find on the page in describing what to assess. So let's just take a look, for those of you that have the toolkit in front of you, at the first area that you're going to assess, and that's your administration, your policies, and your guidelines. So for those of you that have the toolkit, we're looking at page 5. And what you're going to be looking for there are things like your mission statement or your introductory materials. You don't have a mission statement? This might be a good opportunity to think about creating one. You probably have an informal understanding in your group or organization of what you're all about. But many programs and organizations find that concretizing this and writing it down is an opportunity to clarify for everybody what your group's mission really is, and to add elements to the mission that are important to some members, but not other that other members weren't aware of. If you don't have a mission statement written down and you don't want to write one down, you know, clearly that's up to you, but you should spend a little time talking about what is your mission, what is it generally understood to be. When people are first introduced to your program, if you don't have introductory materials like a pamphlet about your organization or information for new members, then you're going to want to think a little bit about how you introduce people to the organization, what you say, and how you say it. Policies and guidelines and rules of conduct. Hopefully you have those. It's great if they're written down. It certainly can help for them to be written down when people are behaving in ways that aren't comfortable for the group or that create problems for your group. In our experience, most peer-run programs have some form of formalized rules of conduct and policies and guidelines. Here, if you don't, you're going to want to look at what is the commonly understood version of those. And we advise that you might want to take an effort to write some of these things down and get consensus within your larger organization that those are solid factors and rules of conduct that people feel comfortable with. Your conflict or grievance procedures, what are those? how the people that are having a problem with your organization bring it forward to the leadership or to the membership. And how do you get feedback from your members? Is it a formalized process? Do you do a satisfaction survey, or do you discuss on a regular basis how people are feeling and whether they're satisfied with services? Do you do this kind of on the cuff? This is an opportunity to reflect on that and see how you actually engage in that process. What's your agenda of diversity activities for the year? Don't have any? Well, then you're not going to be able to give yourself the highest rating on this aspect of cultural diversity. The activities don't need to be expensive, but do you celebrate a variety of holidays or make sure to include ethnic foods from the most prevalent cultural groups when you have food at your organization? That type of thing. Do you have a diversity committee or an appointed person that's in charge of planned and organized diversity activities? And do you have any designated funding to support multicultural activities in your group or program? Now, I'm sure some of you are laughing about the idea of designated funding for cultural diversity, because some of you don't have any funding at all, or are relying on the donations that your members make, or beg, borrow, and steal economy for your organization. But if you do have a budget, do you set aside some portion of that to focus on activities and processes related to diversity? These are all the things you're going to think about when you go and assign yourself a score on page 6, where you're going to rate your administration, your policies, and guidelines. You'll see that if you give yourself a 1, you'll have agreed that your program doesn't yet have formal policies or guidelines that address cultural competency, that you don't have a committee or a group of individuals or even a single individual whose responsibility is to pay attention to this. And if you have funding, you don't allocate any of it specifically to this purpose. You might give yourself a 2 if you're aware of the most prevalent cultural groups in your local area, if there are some people at your organization, either a committee or an individual, who sees this as their mission or one of the things that they're responsible for. You may have some aspects of the importance of diversity and respecting people's beliefs and sexual orientation and culture in your mission statement. And you may have in your policies and procedures that it's not okay to use racial epithets or slurs or to discriminate against people. If you give yourself a 3, you'll see there the things that you should be able to say and show about your organization. And if you give yourself a 4, you can see also there are things like that you have cultural guidelines and cultural competency guidelines and policies, but you've been able to obtain or fundraise a little money specifically devoted to this effort. Or that you regularly talk to cultural leaders in your local community about whether your program is meeting diverse groups' needs and how it might be improved. Or that your strategic planning process for the year or the quarter includes attention to this feature. We often have people who say, well, we've got like 2 out of the 4 things of a 2 and 1 out of the 3 things of a 3. What should we rate ourselves? The answer to this question is, we don't really care. This is really a decision for your group and your organization to make. If you feel you're a 3, rate yourselves as a 3. If you feel you're a 2 is really more a true rating of where your organization stands in regard to its administration policies and guidelines, then give yourselves a 2. It's not a test. It's not a competition. For me, I think giving yourself a lower rating rather than a higher rating gives your organization a chance to make some changes that show some forward forward progress. So there's no real benefit to overrating yourself. At the same time, there's no benefit to underrating yourself. You do want to celebrate any aspects of your program that are already in line with some of these goals and activities. Take a look at how they came to be and see whether that process is one that you can build on as you go forward with your assessment and creating your action plan. You'll move on to take a look at how the peers in your organization provide services, how the group leaders interact with group members. Let's say you're a DBSA support group or a peer-to-peer support group. So there you're going to be looking at the cultural composition of your staff, if you think of them as staff, or your volunteers, if you have volunteers, or your membership. Do they reflect the most prevalent non-white cultural groups in your local area? Do you have training and education that you give to the people that are in your program, either as staff or as members? If you have personnel files, if you're a program that's lucky enough to have a budget and be able to pay people for some of the work that's done in your program or in your group, does the personnel file have information about whether people are receiving training and getting experience in enhancing their cultural competency? Observe the interactions among diverse peer staff and volunteers and see whether those include evidence of cross-competence and communication skills. And you'll see more about that in focus area number 5. And do staff and volunteers interact with each other appropriately and sensitively? This all involves interacting and observing the interactions that go on in your agency. And if you turn to page 19, you'll see the different ways in which you can use the information that you've gathered to give yourself a 1, 2, 3, or 4 on communication and language capacity at your program. Once again, you may find that you have some things that span the ratings. Just have a discussion and give yourself the most honest rating you feel you can give your group or your organization. Next, you're moving on to services and supports. What kind of activities your program engages in, what kinds of services you give people. If you don't think of yourself as providing services, perhaps you think of yourself as providing recovery support and recovery information. So what are the levels of awareness among your staff and your membership about different cultural traditions and customs related to mental illness, to help seeking, and to recovery? Are people aware that people that come from different cultures and different backgrounds may have different issues related to help seeking, may define their mental health difficulties in different ways? And is there knowledge about that among your staff and your membership? Do the services and supports and activities that your program engages in incorporate multicultural beliefs and approaches? What's the cultural composition of your membership? To what extent does it match the most prevalent cultural groups in your local area? And what's the ability of your staff, your leadership, and your volunteers to listen to and to engage diverse people who might come to your program? And these are the pieces of evidence that you're going to use to do the rating of your services and support that you'll do on page 12. And there you'll take a look at what you're currently doing and what you've observed to assign to your program or to your group a 1 through a 4 rating for that particular dimension. Next, you're going to be thinking about your program or group environment. And if you turn to page 15, you'll see where to look in your program to be able to get information that your group will then discuss in order to make the rating about the program or group environment. What kinds of decorations are up in your program? What kinds of posters are displayed? What kind of artwork is there? What kinds of holidays does your program celebrate? To what extent are diverse groups represented among the peers in your program or your group? To what extent would someone coming in from a different culture or orientation walk into your program's location and feel at home or not feel at home? And based on that, you're going to turn to page 16 and give yourself a rating regarding your program or group environment. Finally, you'll turn to the last area, communication and language capacity. This can be one of the hardest parts of your program to observe. And here you're primarily going to be observing how people interact in your program. Do people use respect in the way that they interact with each other that might relate to people's different cultures and different groups? What kind of languages are your program materials available in? Any other than English? Or if you're in a predominantly Spanish-speaking area, yet there are Anglos in your local community, are materials also available in English? Are you accessible for individuals who are deaf or hearing impaired? What might you do if someone contacted you through, let's say, a deaf relay system, if you didn't have a TTY or a telephone for the deaf, and said, you know, I'm calling for a deaf caller, he or she would like to find out what kinds of services they could access at your program. What would your program be able to say if they got a relay call of this type? What about your accessibility to individuals who are blind or visually impaired or people who are in a wheelchair? What level of accessibility to people with other kinds of communication difficulties, in addition to mental health problems, what would they experience? And there you'll turn to page 19 and you'll give your program a rating in regard to communication and language capacity. This is a very, very difficult one. Most programs do not have interpreter services for the deaf already. They don't have the ability to translate or haven't gotten around to translating some of their materials into a variety of different languages. So this is typically not one that programs can give themselves a high score in. The good thing about that is there are a lot of small changes that you can make in your program to be able to show the next time you conduct your assessment, and we recommend that you conduct it at least once a year, more so if you're engaged in an ambitious action plan that Steve will be talking about in a moment, so that you can look for change in your organization. But there are some small changes that you can do to make your program more accessible in a linguistic sense. So that's how you conduct the assessment. It's not magic. There's nothing really magical about the difference between a 2 or a 3. It's an attempt to get you to think a little bit about whether you're at the low end of achievement and facets of cultural competency in each of the areas that Marie presented about, or whether you're at the high end of that. Maybe you want to focus on another one of the 5 areas of cultural competency. The important thing is to be honest, to take a good, clear look at your program, and remember that in doing so, what you should be keeping in the back of your mind is, what could we do about some of what we've identified by putting it into our plan, our action plan, that will come after this assessment in order to move our organization or move our support group forward? So thanks for listening about that. What we're going to do now is turn it over to Steve, who's going to talk a little bit about how to develop your action plan, what goes into that plan, and how to create a plan that's workable, not too ambitious, but ambitious enough to move you forward. Steve?
Thank you, Judith. On page 23 of the tool book, if you have that, you'll see the one per page Our Diversity Action Plan. You may also have received, as Judith mentioned earlier, the more extensive or complete Cultural Competence Action Plan. That's actually 5 pages, one full page for each of the focus areas. On the 5-page form, what you'll see on there is each focus area listed, and then the second column will be the objective, where you can put in what it is that you want to accomplish based around the ratings and discoveries that you may have made during the process that was described earlier. And then there are also the steps. So what do you want to accomplish, and what are the smaller steps to make that come about? A really key part of the action plan, and it's listed in the third column, is who's going to be responsible for taking that step in order to accomplish that objective. Also, on the form, there's a notes column so that during the process of your work, you can make notations or other considerations that come to mind, other specific details that you need to keep track of. Also important in the fifth column is the target date. What is the date that you are proposing or that you're hoping to accomplish the objective and all of the steps that lead up to it? Listing, of course, who is responsible for each of those steps. So what is your target date? And then actually in the last column, what is the finish date? What is the date that actually the steps were taken, the objective met, and the activity has been accomplished? A couple of considerations in making the Cultural Competence Action Plan are to, as Judith mentioned earlier, it's possible to meet weekly. The great purpose of this is to build up a sense of momentum that can keep things moving and keep a clear focus on what it is that you want to accomplish. And it's also important to use an action plan, whether you use the one page that's in the guide or the supplemental five-page form. It's really important to write this down so that it can be a shared roadmap of activity and also can be developed and modified as an action plan. One of the other considerations in doing an action plan is truly to pick modest, workable, achievable goals and the steps to carry out those goals. One of the perhaps tough things that peer groups can do is get very enthusiastic about the assessment and then come to the action plan and create so many different objectives and steps and complexity that it can be insurmountable or feel quite insurmountable to actually make any progress. It can be really surprising, and we'll get to this in just a moment or two, that some of the small steps that are made can actually build up enthusiasm and welcome, and all sorts of things can happen as a result of the seemingly simplest of actions. So we also recommend that if you focus on the first 6 months that you would like to be working on, so that way you'll be able to actually see within a relatively short amount of time the positive impact of your work. Or should you get results or have an experience that gives you other information, you'll be able to modify what your objectives and your steps are. So, consistency, writing it down, having a plan that you can actually use as a roadmap, picking modest, achievable goals. These are all important, and a couple of minor points are that if you have a learning style that might feel a little intimidated about putting something actually down in writing, use flip chart paper or use large sheets of paper on a wall and use sticky notes for each of the columns. And that way, you can have, if folks are more tactile or are touch-oriented in terms of their learning style, it'll be a great way to be able to engage different folks and be able to move some objectives and steps around so that you can finalize what your action plan is that you end up trying to implement. Here are some considerations for developing your action plan, and we're now going to look at some examples from the action plans of some of the peer-run program pilot sites that we work with in developing this tool. And for that, I would like to turn it over to Marie. Marie?
Thanks, Steve. So the examples that I'm going to talk about are from the pilot tests that we conducted after writing the manual and assessment tool. And for the pilot, we worked with 9 different organizations for a 3-month period. As Judith mentioned, these organizations were from different parts of the country, and they ranged from very small, having 1 employee and the rest volunteer staff, to some being rather large organizations with multiple locations that had done extensive work on multicultural issues. So each organization made an action plan, and we talked to the programs on a bi-weekly basis about their progress.
here are some of the things that they chose to work on. And because these programs were so different in terms of size and composition and the work that they'd already done on multicultural issues, they provided a wide range of different ideas in their action plans. And so some of these ideas will hopefully be helpful and relevant to your program. So in terms of the first focus area, administration policy and guidelines, the smallest program in our pilot didn't really have many written materials, and they were in the process of developing written policies for their organization. And when we started the pilot, they were just completing their employee and volunteer handbook. So they decided to include a focus on cultural competency in the handbook as well. Another program started listening sessions as a way to get feedback from their program participants. And they asked specifically about inclusivity, whether the program was responsive to the needs of diverse people. In regards to the second focus area, peer providers and group leaders, there were a number of activities included in the action plans. One program had two African-American social workers come in and talk about ways in which the African-American community views mental illness. After this training, the program also added historic events to their cultural calendar. For example, they added the anniversary of when women got the right to vote. They also added Brown versus the Board of Education, which was when the Supreme Court determined that schools could no longer be segregated and they needed to be integrated so that everybody all went to school together, whites and African Americans. And the program also reported that these discussions led them redefine their concept of recovery. They said that it is not just symptom management, but it was a consolidation process of learning who we are, developing an awareness of one's culture and of the culture of others, and that they felt that they needed to include that in their definition. And in this example, you can see that some of these activities may actually span a couple of different focus areas, and that some of the plans that you make in one area may promote change in some of the other areas as well. Another program invited someone from a local university to do a training on cultural competency. They didn't know anybody offhand, so they reached out to faculty in gender studies and African American studies departments in order to find someone willing to do the training for them. A program in California decided to add a question about cultural relevancy and inclusiveness to their interview process to try to hire people and interview volunteers, and that they hoped that this question would help identify individuals who had either already been working on cultural competency or who were interested in focusing on this issue. And for this section on services and supports, one program started an art class where participants were asked to create art related to their culture or background. This program held an art show a few months later to show off everyone's creation, and then they also displayed some of the art at their program on a long-term basis after the art show. Another program decided to look for diverse cultural and social resources in their community, and they created a list for members as part of their list of resources and referrals. One program decided to take a trip to a civil rights museum to kind of educate everybody. And another program that was trying to bring in more diverse members decided to offer GED classes as a way to help people get more familiar with the center so that they might feel comfortable coming for other services as well. For the fourth program area, program or group environment, one program included in their action plan that they would hang diversity posters, prayer flags, and Hmong decorations, because that was the prevalent cultural group in their area. And they also wanted to have copies available of the LGBT paper, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender paper that was from their area as well, to make people feel welcome and to be a place where people could get that information. Another program decided to have a monthly cultural night with food and music reflecting different nationalities and racial groups. And one larger program talked about how they always had an annual picnic. And this year, after participating in the pilot program, they decided the upcoming picnic would have a multicultural focus, and they would include storytelling. They had a Filipino singer who came, different kinds of ethnic food, and multicultural dancing. So you can see some of the programs were able to incorporate a focus on diversity into activities that they were already doing, such as the picnic and the employee manual. So your program doesn't always have to do something that is focused exclusively on cultural competence. Diversity issues can be incorporated into some of the things you're already working on. And for the final focus area, communication and language capacity, in order to be more welcoming to Spanish-speaking individuals, Moulton program that was located in Arizona decided to offer basic Spanish classes to peer staff and members. And another program sought out interns that spoke languages of the prevalent cultural groups in their area to be able to be more accommodating to those groups. As Judith mentioned, changes in terms of language and communication can often be the most difficult to achieve, and some programs focus on creating signs that use pictures instead of words to be more sensitive to language barriers. But it often takes time to build trust with other communities and find multilingual peers or volunteers who can work with members in their native languages. So changes in this area may take more time for some of the programs. Again, remember that throughout the assessment tool, there are many tips regarding different activities you can include in your action plan. So definitely take a look at those. There are some great ideas there. So now Steve is going to talk to you about some resources you can use to help your program become more culturally competent.
Thank you, Marie. In the tool book on page 27, there's an appendix of resources, and I'd like to walk through a couple of the websites that are listed and give a couple of comments about some of the websites that can be very helpful in helping you find out what's going on, who's who in your community. First of all, the Multicultural Accent Action Center at NAMI has some materials in different languages and some other tip sheets. There's also the Surgeon General's report on mental health, particularly for underserved communities, including GLBTQ individuals. The National Center for Cultural Competence is also listed there. And there's also the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Health Access Project. So there's a lot of information in the resource, one of which I'd like to go in a little more in depth on is the Census Bureau information that's available at factfinder.census.gov. Now, just to let you know in advance, if you go to that website, you'll see that because of the recent census that was conducted, the website address is going to change, and in the fall, the current website address that's listed on page 29 will no longer be active, but the new web address for that is going to be factfinder2, all one word, .census.gov. Now, if you were to go to the Census Bureau website, you would be able to plug in, as was mentioned earlier, your zip code, your state, your city, and you would be able to find the breakdown of who lives where you live, who makes up the folks who are there in terms of sex and age, how many people are in each household, what kinds of relationship in terms of spouse, children, non-married relatives, racial or breakdown by Latino, Asian, African American or Black, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, American Indian, Native Alaskan. You'll be able to see all this these breakdowns in numbers will help you determine what some of the needs could be of the folks, or at least who to go to make sure that they're included in your action plan and to making your services and your programs more culturally competent, inclusive, and diverse. So if you go to the Census Bureau website, you'll be able to plug in your zip code, state, city, or town, be able to get information. And also, what I'd recommend that's not necessarily listed, but it's a very simple activity that you can do, is to take a bus ride, take a car ride, take a bike ride, walk around, do an actual visual community mapping. Look in your grocery store and look at those little racks that have different flyers and local neighborhood newspapers. Look and see what's around you. It can be amazing, some of the obvious things that can jump out if you look at your environment with an open mind and an inclusive heart. So, particularly with the Census Bureau site and with some of the other cultural competence tools that are listed, you can get a pretty good picture of who is in your community, who you might want to reach out to or include or invite, what you might expect expand into based on that you give yourself for your assessment. And also, it can give you a tip on what a new future can be for your services, your programs, and the quality and effectiveness of what you do. That was a quick rundown of the Census Tracker webpage. There are other sites that's mentioned listed in the back that you encourage to check out. And with this conclusion of the rundown of the resources, at least a brief summary of the back resources, I'd like to open up now to questions and feedback. And before I do that, I want to ask Judith and Marie if you have any other comments before we get to some of the questions.
Hi, Steve. What I wanted to do was to re-announce the email address that you can send your questions to, and that's cook@ripco.com, C-O-O-K, at R as in Robert, I as in interest, P as in purchase, C as in cook, O as in order.com. And we've received a few questions already, and I'd like to share them with my co-presenters and see if someone would like to step forward and answer one. Here's one of the first ones that came in. How do I deal with a community that isn't very diverse? What do you do in that situation? Someone like to handle that one?
Yes, Judy, I'll handle this. This is Steve. I would recommend, first of all, that if you want to find out what kinds of dimensions of diversity exist, you can look beyond what you've already know to be true in your community. What you can do if you think you're already isn't very diverse, you can look at other dimensions of diversity, such as age, ethnic heritage, race, mental or physical abilities and characteristics, gender, sexual orientation, military experience, religion or non-religious view, income levels, geographic location, first language, level of education, family status, communication style. So if you don't think that there's any diversity in terms of the more stereotypical and more easily identifiable categories of differences of race, you can always look at other dimensions of diversity that can help you find out and how to be more diverse, even if you seemingly have a pretty common set of characteristics for the group that you're in. Judith and Marie, would you like to add anything?
No, I think that was a great answer, Steve. Let me share with the group another one of the questions that came in. What if the members of my organization already think they're culturally competent? How do I persuade them that they're not and overcome their resistance to engaging in an assessment and plan? Anyone interested in tackling that? I do know that in at least two of our pilot sites, there were some members of the organizations that showed some level of resistance to this. Not that they didn't think it was a good idea, but that they already felt that their organization did a good job in those areas. Anyone want to tackle that?
Hi, Judith. I'd like to add a couple of things. First, I'd like to remind folks that should that be the case, to recall what Judith mentioned earlier about looking at the dynamics of difference, it also can be very common that because of some unresolved strong feelings or conflicts, it can be very easy to automatically assume or feel, in some ways out of defensive posture, no, we're fine, we're good, everything is good. And so being open to exploring any areas of stress, unresolved conflict, can also be helpful. Another objective action that can be taken is to ask, how do you know that you're already culturally competent? What's your source of information? And here's where some of the surveys can come in handy. And there's a survey that is in the toolbook that can be used, is on page 24. So you could use a diversity survey for any program participants. And also on page 25, there's a diversity survey for peer-run group program leaders. So asking how do you know that you're already culturally competent is important. What are the dynamics of difference that might be at play? Are there any unresolved issues of conflict or personality or other kinds of differences that may be at play? And one thing to keep in mind is that the process of cultural competence is exactly that. It's an ever-ending process. It always continues. There's always more to learn. People come in and go out of communities. So communities are constantly changing dynamic entities, really. The process of cultural competence is a never-ending one. Judith and Marie?
Thanks, Steve. I do recall that in both of those pilot sites, the person or people that felt that this was an unnecessary exercise were listened to and given an opportunity to air their opinions. And then the group went forward anyway. And in both cases, the people that had thought that the program was already culturally competent saw over time that while they still felt this was true, that it would be possible to enhance their cultural competency, that it's not an end state, and that there are things that you can engage in to make a good program even better. So this resistance did not continue in the two pilot sites that were in our pilot test. So I think it's worth pointing that one out.
Yeah, I also wanted to add, I was just going through some of the notes about we had had a call during the pilot with Mahaze Carrasco over at NAMI, and she had kind of talked about the importance of creating a safe space for people who protest kind of reaching out to diverse groups or who are more reluctant or who may feel that they've already done this kind of work. And that this doesn't mean that you have to stop doing the diversity work that the organization is doing, but to create a space where some people can kind of talk about this and maybe work through some of their fears and express some of the barriers and misunderstanding that may be at the root of some of these ideas.
And I just wanted to emphasize and echo that, acknowledging that there could be some fear and anxiety because of working with individuals or communities that might not have been experienced before for many folks. So acknowledging that possible fear and anxiety and giving that safe space truly is an important thing.
Okay, here's another question that has come in. What were some of the common challenges that pilot sites faced with the action plan?
I can address that. We actually have some of that listed in the tool itself on page 22. And I would say probably the first one that most of the programs mentioned when we first started this was funding. And I think, you know, particularly now we're in a very difficult funding time where it's hard to come by money and a lot of places are having funding cuts. So I think that some of what we wanted to kind of focus on with folks was the idea that some of these changes don't cost money. Maybe some of the changes that you might make to some of your policies and things like that wouldn't cost money. And that, you know, having like a potluck where you're bringing in different kinds of ethnic food, that that wouldn't necessarily cost the organization any kind of money. But there were also some organizations that thought of different ways that they might be able to raise some money to do a few things that weren't as costly, maybe having a bake sale or a car wash to do something. And that sometimes you can get art from some of the people in your program who would be willing to lend posters or things like that. For getting gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender newspapers, you can often just let, if you have a paper in your area, let them know that you're willing to be a drop-off point, and they'll just give you the papers. They'll drop them off once a week. And that some of the organizations actually looked into applying for some grants or some funding to begin to do some multicultural activities. So I think that some of the areas didn't necessarily cost a lot of money, particularly Section 1 around administrative policies, and the section around the space, you know, one of the groups actually did an art group as a way to create some decorations and things like that. So I think there are creative ways to kind of deal with the funding issue.
Thanks, Marie. I wanted to mention another program, or another problem that a couple of the pilot sites dealt with, I thought very creatively, having to do with reaching out to communities that were not very responsive after they were reached out to. And in these cases, cases, what we've had a competency consultant come and be on the call and talk to them. Mahose was one, and we got some ideas from others who suggested that inviting people to come to your program to learn about it isn't the respectful way that people make friends in many cultures. Instead, what is seen as more respectful is when a peer program reaches out to another group and asks if it could come and attend one of their activities or festivals or functions, and doesn't bring up right away, we're coming for the purpose of inviting you to our program, but basically makes friends in a more gradual way, in a way that says, first, we'd like to get to know about you and what your group does and what it's all about, and only later introduces the idea that they would like the members of that group to come into their organization. So that was definitely something that two of the programs learned and changed their strategies so that they could actually learn about the culture and also begin to forge relationships that felt comfortable to the organizations that they were outreaching. We've received an email from one listener who suggests that we remind folks that sometimes your state or your city may have an office of diversity as part of its local government that you can tap into for resources, for translations of materials, and for posters and things that your organization can use for free to help celebrate diversity. So I wanted to mention that suggestion and thank our audience for contributing ideas. Here's a question. Do you have resources that a person could use for translations of their mission statement or their brochure?
This is Marie. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, will use some of the websites that may do translation for you. And the hard part about that is that they sometimes are incorrect. And it's often because of the way language is. But a coworker here used one of those sites in order to advertise a school event that was going on. And then I actually speak some Spanish, so I was going through it. And I was like, what is it about the little goats? I don't understand why there are little goats coming. And then I realized there was a translation for kids. So, you know, I think translation is a hard thing. And, I mean, one program had looked into trying to get some interns, also reaching out to try to find some volunteers who might be able to do something like that, since it is a costly service. But it is really important to utilize someone who can actually translate correctly, because I think that sometimes you can do a little bit more harm than good if it's not exactly, if it doesn't make sense and if it isn't correct.
I also wanted to mention that if you're lucky enough to live near a local community college or university, a call to the chair of the department to ask whether it might be possible for, as a community service, someone on the faculty or one of the students to do a limited amount of translating for your program was a way that one program that actually was trying to outreach a number of different Asian communities in its local area was able to get some free translating done. So I think we've reached the end of our hour, and I would just like to thank everyone who has been on today's call, who sent in questions and contributed ideas, and also applaud you for being interested in this topic and willing to consider using our tool. Steve, do you have some closing comments that you'd like to add?
Yes, I also want to say thank you to those folks taking part, and also to please give yourself credit for taking part in this call and your curiosity to expand your cultural competence and diversity. And also want to say thank you to SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, for the funding that made this teleconference possible. Also want to remind you that those who registered will be receiving by email an evaluation survey to let us know what you think about this teleconference, what you liked about it, what you thought was helpful, what you thought could be improved, or what you'd like to see for future teleconferences. And lastly, just a reminder that the tool is available at our website, www.consumerstar.org, and also at the Judith and Marie's website. And Judith, or Marie, could you please give us your website address again?
Offhand, we don't know it. It's kind of long.
So go to Steve's website and get it there.
Right.
Okay. We've got actually www.cmhsandsantarp.uic.edu. Lastly, I want to thank you, Judith and Marie, for your expertise and your knowledge and your time. And again, thank you for participants. Thank you to SAMHSA. And this formally concludes this teleconference, and we wish you much recovery, wellness, and a very diverse and abundant community. Thank you.